Sota per Gimel Mishnah Dalet 3-4. There is a great deal that goes on in this Mishnah here. The first part discusses what it looks like to an observer if a woman is indeed guilty of being a Sota and she drinks the water. So now, this Mishnah is assuming that the Minchas Kana'os, the Mincha that was offered, is offered first, and then she drinks second, which was according to Rabbi Shimon Shita back in Mishnah Beis, and this is like Rabbi Akiva. Others say no. As you remember, the Chacham is say that first she drinks and then her mincha is brought. She won't experience the consequences of the waters until after the mincha is brought. That's for sure. So our Mishnah is assuming the mincha is brought first, which means that the effects can kick in right away, and that's what the Mishnah says happens. Eina maspekas lishtos. She just, you know, doesn't have a chance. Literally means doesn't even get a chance to finish drinking the water. But the Gemara actually says it won't take effect until she actually drinks. But the point here is, immediately upon drinking the waters, the effects begin. Ad shepaneh morikos, her face turns like greenish, pallid. Ve'eneh boltos, her eyes like sort of bulge out of the sockets. Vehi mismales giden, and she becomes like full of like veins, meaning the veins in her face and her cheeks bulge. Vem omrim hotziwa hotziwa, and the people who are looking at her see this and they actually will be moved to panic and they'll say, get her out of here, get her out of here, take her out. Shelo titameh ha'azara, so she doesn't cause the azara to become tummy. Now, this requires just a bit of clarification. This is what people are screaming, I guess, when they see her, you know, on her in her what seems like her death throes. Important to note, she actually isn't in the Azara. She's in the Ezras Nashim, you recall, which is at Shar Nicanor at the entrance to the Azara, but she's not in the Azara proper. And this Azara therefore means Ezras Nashim, which doesn't have the same halachas as the Azara. They're basically, it was learned back in the encampments in the desert, in the Midbar, there were kind of three zones, the Machane Yisrael, Machane Leviya, and Machane Shechina, which different levels of sanctity, depending on your proximity to where the Aron was, and there are different rules in terms of Tum and Tahara. The Azara, and what's in it, has the same status as the Machane Shechina, and that you can't have any exposure to any Tum, including Tumas Mace, a dead body. But the next level out, the Machane Leviya, is analogous to the Temple Mount. And there, actually, you can have a Tamei Meis go, who can't be on the Temple Mount area, is someone who's got Tuma Yotzim Gufo, Tuma coming from his person, like, for example, a Zav or a Nida. So the point here, says the Bar Tanura, they're afraid that she, in her, like, death throes, as her body sort of begins to unravel, will actually like have nida blood, which will make her tamea, and that will be forbidden. So they're saying, get her out of here quickly, so that shouldn't happen. Okay, I believe the point of this sentence of the Mishnah is just to emphasize that it's evident to anybody who's looking at her that she's on the way to die immediately. Im yesh la zchus, however, says the Mishnah, if she has zchus, merits, which according to most means the zchus specifically of Talmud Torah, which protects against Yisurin, suffering, and her primary zchus presumably would be, as far as Talmud Torah goes, that she is an enabler of Talmud Torah, meaning she brings her children to go to yeshiva, she waits for her husband to come back from the Beis Midrash, and therefore she's facilitating Talmud Torah, and that's a zchus for her. So then, says the Tana of our Mishnah, and we'll see the other shitas in other Tanayim, but according to a ton of our Mishnah, Haisa Tolala, that will actually delay her suffering, I mean her death, I'll call it, and it could be actually for a good amount of time. That actually everyone agrees to. The part that is unique to this particular Tana is how long it could prevent her from dying. And it says here, Yesh l'schus tola shana achas, she could have merits that save her for a whole year from dying. Yesh zchus tola shtei shanim, she could have a zchus that actually saves her for two, and yesh zchus shetola shalosh shanim, even for 3 years, her death could be staved off because of her merits. Now, this doesn't mean that he, the paramour, the guy who she slept with, will be saved. He dies as well, and that could happen to him immediately. It also doesn't mean she doesn't get sick right away. You see, she is going to start her decline towards death promptly. morality, probably. It's maybe not there that second in the Base of English, but she'll start to decline right away. But her death won't come, even for up to 3 years, according to this Tana, Rabbi Shmuel, because of her merit of Talmud Torah. So says the Mishnah now. Now we're going to segue into the topic of women learning Torah in general. Mekan Omer ben Azai. Ben Azai says, from here you see that Chayv Adon Lamed Es Bito Torah. A person is obligated to, he ought to teach his daughter Torah. She'im Tishte. So that way, if she ends up having to go through this very rigmarole, this very procedure, Teida Shazachus Tolala. She'll know that if death doesn't come immediately, that the reason is it's because of her Talmud Torah and her zchuyos that are protecting her, and therefore she shouldn't come to, denigrate the waters or not think they're true and so on. So he actually says, Ben Azai, you ought to teach your daughter Torah. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, no. Rabbi Eliezer says you shouldn't teach your daughter Torah. Kol ha-malamed bito Torah. Anyone who teaches his daughter Torah, here we're talking about Torah Shebaal Peh, not Torah Shebechsav. But if you teach your daughter Torah Shebaal Peh, ki'ilu malamda tiflus, it's like teaching her promiscuity, something like that. Tiflus is not a very nice term at all. The Rambam learns it's a reference to, like, she'll take the Torah and make it into, like, frivolity and, silliness. That's a much less sharp accusation, but you'll see from the context of our mission itself later on, tiflus really refers to, intimacy, and it's not a nice expression at all. So the point is, she'll become like a sophisticated, savvy, cunning woman who actually will use that savvy to get away with impropriety, promiscuity, says Rabbi Eliezer. Now, interestingly, the Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, codify this sheet of Rabbi Eliezer that a person ought to not teach his daughter Torah. We're talking here not about Torah Bichsav, which he may teach, we're talking about Torah Shebaal Peh. More than that, the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, says, of course, a woman has to learn the halachas that apply to all of her mitzvahs. She has to know how to keep Shabbos so she can, she has to learn Hilchos Shabbos, but learning Hilchos Shabbos so she can keep Shabbos is it's not the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, it's just the Hechsher mitzvah of Shabbos, of Zechira Shabbos, or Shmir Shabbos, I should say. Or it may also be like a mitzvah of Yiras Hashem, let's say, but it's not a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. So that being the case, the Shulchan Aruch, like I said, does say that one ought not teach his daughter Torah. Already there are, like in the Chavetz Chaim's time, Rav Moshe, certainly Rav Soloveitchik, they said that nowadays girls ought to be taught Torah. The Chavetz Chaim says it's essential they're taught Torah so they stay on the right path. Not only Tanakh, but also like Pirkei Avos and other like Divrei Musar. Rav Moshe matters it, others do as well. Some focus that the point of the prohibition against a father teaching his daughter means the expectations of the daughter on the father or the father himself, kind of forcing her to learn. But if she's self-motivated to do so, it's different. And whatever the case is, certainly in the Jewish world today, in the English-speaking Jewish world for sure, girls do learn Torah, including Torah Shebaal Peh. That seems to be, loosely speaking, the consensus of the various postcom today. Okay, so now moving on from that topic, the Mishnah continues on, and it says that this is now Rabbi Yeshua, very possibly going a little off topic here. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Rotza Isha Bakav Vitiflus Metisha Kaban Uprishus. It could be this is a, some learn that this, like the Kahati brings, this is a reason why one ought not teach his daughter Torah, because this is how her mind thinks, but it's not necessarily connected in my mind at all. Rabbi Yeshua here is saying that a woman would rather have some, like, I'll call it material privation, less like food to eat and other material things, but have intimacy with her husband than having lots of food and other material stuff, but essentially not having intimacy with her husband. So that's what we say here literally. Rotza Isha Bakav. A woman would rather have a kav. A kav refers like a little amount. Literally, it's like 2 liters. The one is a small amount of food. But Chazal many times, like for example, the famous Chazal, it says a person would rather have his own kav that he worked hard for, even though it's a small amount, than tisha kav and the nine kav that someone else, you know, did, earned. And a person would rather have his own stuff. The point here is you're contrasting one kav with nine kav and so on. So we have that here as well. Similarly, the kav, like, you know, Chanina Mendoza and Shem lived on a kav of carobs from week to week to support the world. The point is the kav is like a small amount. It's the idea of a small measure. So the point is, wouldn't rather have a kav, a little bit of that kind of, let's call it food and so on, the tiflus, but have intimacy, physical intimacy with her husband, metisha kav and uprishus, then having lots of, like nine kav and lots of, let's call it food, etc., but uprishus, but being separated from her husband and not having physical intimacy. Hu haya omer, now Rabbi Yeshua goes further, and he's going to list now four categories of people that are mechale olam, that ruin the world. So now, what does it mean to ruin the world? So the Bar Tanura just seems to say that it means that, you know, these people mess up society because they are misleading in their behavior and they're not, you know, and they mess the world because of their, like, I'll call it insincerity. The Rambam and the Perish Mishnayos, and see Tos Yom Tov, learn something like very fascinating to me, that it's these people are all inauthentic human beings. They're sort of lost their basic humanity, or they're hiding who they really are. And since the purpose of existence was for people to become yashar, rectify themselves, develop a relationship with Hashem, and, you know, be davak bo, to connect to Hashem, and if they, you know, are essentially lose their sense of self, their identity, they become inauthentic people, lacking integrity. You know, in my mind, like, you know, I can imagine an actor who's, you know, after 30 years of playing different roles, they wonder, like, who am I? Like, who's the real me? What's the real me? So that person who loses their identity, so they sort of lost the whole point of existence, and that's like a wiping out the whole point of the world. So now, what are these four categories of people that are listed? The first is the Chassid Shota. Chassid Shota, literally a Chassid is a pious person who goes beyond the letter of the law, very religious, but Shota, he's a fool. The point is here, his religiosity has sort of obscured his own basic humanity. So the examples are like a fellow who sees a woman drowning, who says, oh goodness, like, you know, there she is in a bikini, I can't go to her and save her. So he lets her drown because he's too religious and pious to go deal with a girl in the ocean and touch her, whatever the story is. So again, you see he lost his basic humanity. I'm thinking he's a religious person, especially his religiosity makes him not want to save her, but of course that's undermining the most basic tenet of our religion, that, you know, that we people shouldn't, obviously should do what you can to save someone from dying, and so on. The other example given is a similar kind of idea where you see a person's wearing tefillin and he sees someone drowning and he says, I'll first take my tefillin off for the sake of the honor of the tefillin before I rescue this person. Again, losing their basic humanity, making a foolish decision, the person drowns because of a supposed religious experience. Again, inauthentic person, and that's terrible. The second example is the Rasha Arum, the cunning, wicked person. Examples given there are either a person who, like, he gets a hold of the judge in his case prior to his counterpart showing up, and he, like, sort of tells the judge his side of the story first. That's an Isra from the Torah already. But the point is, once the judge sees things from his perspective, it's hard to see from another way, so he perverts justice and sort of misleads the situation, sort of, again, having, like, letting the judge have an inauthentic view of him and the world, and so on. The other approach of the Rasha Arum is a person who is strict on other people, like a posuk, let's say, who rules strictly for other people, but he's lenient on himself. So again, people assume he's a very religious person because, look, he's so strict, but actually he's actually not strict at all on himself, just on other people. And that, of course, is certainly inauthentic. It's certainly a terrible thing to do to other people. It's trying to mislead people, and that messes up society, messes up him, messes up his, you know, his, totally loses the sense of who and what he is. The Isha Frusha. Here, they were talking here about a woman. It's hard to translate this exactly, but the idea is that the example given in the Gemara is a woman who essentially causes a problem, and then everyone's panicking how to solve the problem. So she says she's going to pray for a solution, and then she undoes the problem that she caused, and then everyone says, "Oh well, look, it was, you know, God answered her prayers. She's a tzaddikus. And so once people think she's a holy woman, actually she was the cause of the problem in the first place. The actual example is an example of like sort of kishuf and witchcraft, whatever. I don't want to get into that so much. The point is that she's misleading people to think that she is a special holy woman, when in fact she's just a troublemaker who's putting on a show. And the last case is the umakus prushin. This is something like the suffering of the abstinent. It's hard to translate again exactly, but the idea is, again, you got examples like a person who, you know, walks through the streets with his eyes closed because he doesn't want to look at the women, but then he's like, you know, walking into walls because he can't see where he's going. So those are his makos, his injuries that he gets because he's a parish, because he's so, you know, removed from this world. Again, totally inauthentic human experience. He's not that way inclined. The point of our mission here is this person is putting on a show, and therefore that's his inauthenticity, and that's the bad thing here. Alternatively, if it's a person who does some kind of like, you know, self-flagellation, he like, you know, I don't know what, he makes marks on his body as if he's, you know, to people should look at him and say, wow, look at this guy. He punishes himself to try to, for penitence and that kind of thing. And they're misled. So these people, Hare Elu Mechale Olam, these people ruin the world because the world's a much better, much worse place because of them, or because they've lost their sense of self. And as inauthentic people, they sort of undermine the whole point of their coming to the world in the first place, which is, as far as, you know, each person's like an Olam Mala, a world to itself. And this their opportunity for life and what they're supposed to do in this world has been ruined by their inauthentic and really terrible behavior.